Thank you, James. Members of the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, have arrived here in the Civic Center Ballroom in Valdez. 10 o'clock briefing was called only officially about half an hour ago, although rumors about it have been afloat since last night. Later on this morning, we're expecting an update from Exxon at 11 o'clock, and a coalition of environmental activists and organizations have scheduled a press conference for 12 noon. Both these events will be broadcast over KCHU as well. For those stations down the line, we will be feeding every conference that occurs or briefing that occurs at the Civic Center. We'll send them down to the Alaskan Bridge, as well as broadcasting them in Valdez and Cordova. Again, coming up in just a moment, we're expecting the beginning of a press briefing by the NTSB. The NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, is the agency that is investigating the actual events leading to the grounding of the Exxon Valdez. William Woody is about to begin the conference from the podium here in the Civic Center Ballroom. He is the gentleman from the NTSB who hosted or who was the chief speaker at the NTSB press conference that occurred 2 days ago when the group of investigators had first arrived in Valdez. Again, we are standing by for a start any moment. The cameras are all getting
from
their...
from the National Transportation Safety Board. I'm the investigator in charge of a four-man team, including myself, which have been sent up from Washington to investigate the grounding of the Exxon Valdez. I've called this press conference to tell you a few items that we've learned in the course of our interviews. We have small amount of information to pass to you. Basically, we've learned from the interviews that there's an indication that the vessel was on a course of 180. This is based on interviews. I'd be very pleased to speak up. We've learned that the vessel was on a course of 180. We have interviews from the two helmsmen who were steering the course. We also have fixes on the chart which show the vessel's track to be a course of about 180 down to the site of the grounding. Also, the course recorder from the ship clearly shows a course of 180 for a period of 19 to 20 minutes. There were fixes on the chart. One fix at 2339, about the middle of the vessel traffic separations lanes, which showed the vessel was probably taken just before the vessel came to a course of 180. There's a course off Busby Island at 2355, which at this position the vessel is about a half a mile outside of the traffic lanes. And a course of 180 from this position would bring the vessel to the grounding site. The interviews with the helmsman who was on the helm at the time steering the vessel revealed that shortly before the grounding took place, he received a series of orders. The first order he recalled was a right 10 degrees rudder to bring the vessel around to the right, then right 15 followed by right 20. The helmsman recalls that he applied what he referred to as counter rudder to steady the course, to stop the swing of the vessel, and to bring the vessel to a course that he recalled to be 235 or 245. About this time, he received an order from the third officer, the third mate, for hard right rudder. This was followed by what he described as a bumpy ride. At the immediate end of the bumpy ride, or just as it was stopping, he got an order from the third officer for hard left rudder. And then, a few moments later, he remembers getting various orders from the master of the vessel. This is the some information that we have established leading up to the grounding of the vessel at this time. I would like to mention that the board has met with the master and with the third mate and with their attorneys. The two officers have provided us with information on their background, their training, number of trips into Valdez. types of ships they have served in. However, on advice of their counsel, they have declined to discuss the events of the casualty. The attorneys for the two officers have informed the safety board that they will be reviewing the appropriate applicable state and federal laws that might be applicable to their clients. And as soon as their study are complete of the legal ramifications, they will communicate with us regarding discussing the events. The public hearing that was announced to be planned in Anchorage on next Tuesday has been delayed. It has slipped to for some weeks, and you will be advised as soon as a firm time for the hearing is established. We are very pleased to announce that the state is a party to the investigation, and they have nominated a spokesperson, Captain Kelly Mitchell, a master mariner, who is the port captain for the Alaska Marine Highway. Kelly, K-E-L-L-Y, Mitchell, M-I-T-C-H-E-L. And Captain Mitchell is, as I mentioned, a master mariner. In other words, he holds a master's license. He brings some very valuable expertise on marine navigation in the Alaska area. And we appreciate very much the selection by the state and the help. We all will also appreciate the help he will be giving us. He will be a spokesperson for the state. I might explain just for a moment that in NTSB investigations, we use a party system. A party is like a partner or a participant. The parties to our investigation are Exxon Shipping. The parties have an interest in solving the cause of the accident. They will have a spokesperson. A mariner will be appointed by Exxon. We do not have a name at this time. As I mentioned, the state of Alaska is a participant, a party to our investigation, and with Captain Mitchell being the spokesperson for the state. The U.S. Coast Guard is always a full participant, full partner in all of our proceedings, our marine investigations, and they will be represented by Commander Waldron from the Coast Guard. Commander Waldron from Juneau, Alaska. I'll get the spelling of the first name for you. I think this is all the factual information I have to put out to you at this time. I'll be happy to take some questions. In the meantime, I'll get Captain Waldron's complete.
180 is which direction on the compass, sir?
Heading south.
In general, could you take us through what the board does, again, in general, when you're faced with a situation in which you have witnesses you'd like to talk to who are concerned about Fifth Amendment rights? Is there some way that you can, or that you do routinely, offer them some kind of immunity that allows them to then tell you their story without jeopardy? Or exactly how do you handle this problem in general?
We never have in the past had to grant immunity to a witness at an NTSB procedure, to my knowledge, certainly not in the marine area. So this is something which we may have to consider, but at this point, I believe that it has been considered to some extent. And if I had further information, I would pass on to you.
But I'm not sure I understand why that would be. You haven't had a case in the past in which someone might be liable for prosecution under state or federal laws, or that there is generally some conditions that may also operate here that allow the person to eventually tell you their story.
I believe that I cannot think of a case where we've had an accident that was probably as complicated from a legal standpoint as this one here.
Mr. Woody, there are reports that the alcohol test administered to the master of the vessel was taken too late to provide conclusive evidence. and that there was an alcohol test kit aboard the vessel, but it wasn't used. Do you have anything on that?
There was an alcohol test kit on the vessel. The tests were taken somewhat late. The people boarding the vessel were not aware that there was a tox kit on the vessel. However, the tests were taken. We expect the results of the test, as a result of the phone call this morning, to be available to us on Friday.
But wasn't it taken too late to provide conclusive evidence?
It depends on the amount of, perhaps, alcohol in the blood. If there was enough, we might still get an indication.
Will you release the results on Friday, sir, when you receive them?
I look at that and let you know.
What's your understanding the approximate time that test was taken?
I believe the test was taken something like 9:30 in the morning.
Mr. Woody, are there requirements, federal or otherwise, that says a pilot who has a suspended driver's license cannot command a tanker of this size?
There's no regulations that I'm aware of, and I believe there are none.
What about the fact that the gentleman who was in charge of the helm at the time was not licensed for operating in these waters? Is that true?
That's true.
Why was he allowed that responsibility?
There are things that happen that are not provided for. I can't answer that question at this time because we haven't been able to speak to the captain and to the third mate regarding the events. I might further mention, however, that the enforcement of the regulations is a Coast Guard responsibility. Our concern is primarily to the development of the evidence and analysis to determine how the accident happened.
Mr. Woody, you described the last moments prior to the collision as being a series of course changes. Would you describe those as having been done in a panic or in an orderly way, or how would you characterize what happened?
The helmsman indicated that he got the order for right 10, right 15, right 20, and that they seemed to be routine orders to him to come to a course of 235 or 245.
Was that attempting to avoid collision or anything like that?
No, it was just a matter, it would appear to be, of course, they're directed back toward the traffic lanes.
You said the helmsman also received orders from the master toward the end of this sequence, so that would put the master on the bridge at that time.
You were fairly specific about the orders that were being given prior to the master being on the bridge. What orders was the master giving when he got there?
He gave a series of orders of right and left, various orders of right and left rudder, and we do not know the purpose of those.
What time had the ship actually struck?
This was after the bumping ride, which probably the helmsman, this would be after the ground.
Mr. Woody, what was the helmsman's explanation as to why the captain was not on deck at the time?
The helmsman at that time did not see the captain. He was not certain whether he was in the wheelhouse or not.
You've not been able to talk to the skipper or the third mate because of their...
No, that's not correct. Yesterday we talked to both the master and the third mate. They provide us evidence on their training, their maritime training, and their job experience.
Did they take the Fifth Amendment when you asked them questions about the accident?
The term Fifth Amendment was not expressly stated, but every witness, every person is provided with that protection, and that would be what they would be exercised.
Did they refuse to answer some questions then about how the accident happened?
That's correct. They declined to discuss the events of the accident.
Is that permissible under their subpoena?
On what grounds did they decline to discuss?
On the advice of their counsel.
Mr. Woody, did the helmsman indicate whether he had ever received orders from the third mate in Prince William Sound before, or whether this was the first time in his
ritual? No, he had received orders here before.
So the third mate had been in command of the ship in those waters?
No, that's not quite an accurate statement. The watch that the helmsman was normally on was the watch which would normally occur after the third mate's watch. Third mate was on watch longer, or that he would normally be on watch.
His watch period extended into the next watch period.
So he was on a double shift?
I wouldn't say a double shift, but the vessel had been working during the day, and we did not know exactly when his shift started. Normally it's a 4-hour shift. Normally it starts at 8 o'clock and goes to midnight, with the relief occurring about 10 minutes before the hour. Now, sometimes it's conceivable that he might have started his watch at a later time when the ship got underway, and that might have extended his watch into the next period.
What I was trying to get at is whether on previous trips the helmsman was asked or indicated that the third mate or someone other than the certified master had commanded the Exxon Valdez through Prince William Sound.
We could not establish that, no.
Mr. Woody, what about the previous reports that the vessel hit a reef and then 15 minutes later came aground? Was that confirmed that they had actually struck an earlier submerged rock?
Not based on the sole description furnished by one helmsman. All he could tell us was that after the hard right rudder, that there was the ship experienced what he described as a bumpy ride.
And also, you're saying that the master, that is the skipper, got involved in the orders right at the end. Suddenly he came in and issued an order to also.
That appears to be the sequence offered us by the soldiers.
So he joined the event toward the end of the event, it sounds like.
It appears to have been afterwards, but shortly afterwards.
So, Mr.
Could you
Woody,
tell
what
the
is
end of the bumpy ride then?
The NTSB's investigation today. Do you intend to interview the captain again, or what will you be doing?
Well, we will expect to interview three witnesses from the ship today. They will be the chief officer, two able seamen on the 20 to 24 watch.
Is that the extent
On the 8 to 12 watch that evening, the watch period that preceded the accident.
Mr. Woody?
The extent of your schedule today?
As far as witnesses are concerned, yes.
Do you know yet, sir, if the master was in the wheelhouse present at the time the Coast Guard granted permission to deviate from their usual course?
First of all, I think that we should characterize the Coast Guard permission was to vary from the outbound lane into the inbound lane as necessary to avoid ice.
But do you know if the master was present at that time of issuance?
We do not know that.
Orders that were being given when you say the ship was probably aground, would they have made the situation worse?
Of course, you're asking to speculate, and I would respectfully decline to do so at this time, but...
Did you tell us the ship was actually aground when after the mate said a bumpy ride? How much time would have elapsed before
this was the steersman, the helmsman, who said this.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell us whether
the ship was aground?
Could you tell us whether the Coast Guard's radar coverage extends beyond the point where the ship is now on the reef?
The radar coverage, under good conditions, will show the ship down there, and under some conditions, it will not.
So where does the coverage area end?
The coverage area starts becoming intermittent about Busby Island.
The ship was visible that night?
The conditions that night were such that the ship probably was not seen on the radar much beyond Busby Point.
Does the Coast Guard have a transmission? Do they record their conversations with the ship, and have you heard those?
They do, and we have those yet to listen to.
Mr. Woody, what was the condition with the ice? Have you been able to determine how much danger to the ship there was with floating ice?
Since we didn't have the testimony of the two persons that were on the bridge, we do not know firsthand. We don't have any first-hand description of the ice conditions.
Do you have any other way of getting ice descriptions other than from interviewing those two persons?
No, 3 hours earlier there was a report from an inbound ship, but the conditions might have changed very dramatically in 3 hours, so we do not know.
What was the report from the inbound ship?
An ARCO ship that was coming in did provide the Vessel Traffic Center with an ice report.
If the Coast Guard gave that vessel permission to veer into the inbound lane, wouldn't that require a series of left turns instead of right turns, and would this have been outside of the purview of what the Coast Guard was giving them permission to do?
I believe the answer to your question is yes. the maneuvers of the ship within the traffic lanes would have been left, coming left. And that was the assumed maneuvers that were that would appear to have been expected.
So but again, I mean, that's would be if someone is the opposite.
We have no way to answer that question at this time.
Have you talked to the three Coast Guardsmen who were in the vessel watch center there?
We have interviewed two of them.
What is their explanation?
Basically, that the weather conditions were good, that the visibility was very good, that everything seemed to be normal, that the vessel requests permission to deviate within the traffic separation scheme as necessary to avoid ice, and that was the extent of it.
Did you ask the helmsman if he thought the captain was intoxicated, and if so, what did he say?
The helmsman could not provide us any information. He did not have an observation that he could
describe. Speak into the microphone.
The helmsman was able to provide us no information in this area.
Are you going to interview the pilot who was the last non-crew member to see the captain?
We have interviewed the pilot.
Did he characterize the captain as being intoxicated?
He characterized the captain as seeming to be completely functional, alert, and capable.
Mr. Wade, I'm concerned about the public hearing. Why were they canceled, and why had you not planned on having them scheduled in Valdez, where the people who are more familiar with the crews and with what was going on, so they would be able to testify at those hearings? And what's the purpose of those hearings?
The purpose of the hearings will be to take testimony under oath to complete our record. As far as the decision of our headquarters to hold in Anchorage or here, I don't know the real reason for that. I presume facilities might have been the answer because of the crowded condition here in Valdez.
Would you consider having some hearings in Valdez?
Our headquarters makes that determination, and in this regard, we do have a public affairs person coming up from Washington who will be here on this tomorrow. And she might provide some insight as to the rationale.
Testimony from people other than the ones you contacted. Are you asking the people in this community who may know something about that vessel to come forward to see you, or are you simply contacting, as it were, subpoenaing people?
We are contacting everyone that we can identify who may be able to provide us information on the events leading up to the accident. If there's anyone who has information, we would welcome them coming forward.
How long do you anticipate being here in this field phase of your investigation?
Another 4 days, 5 days. Maybe longer.
Did the Coast Guard officer who came on board after the incident, or the pilot who left before the incident, say anything about alcohol on the captain's breath?
There was a statement that there was a smell of alcohol.
Who made that statement?
The Coast Guard officer boarding the vessel.
Who?
It's very hard for us to hear you.
We can't hear you, Mr.
Wood.
Can
you pick
up and repeat that?
The Coast Guard officer boarding the vessel.
Said what?
About 2 o'clock in the morning. Said that he detected the smell of alcohol.
Who is that, sir?
Mr. Mark DeLoach.
I'm sorry.
Who is that?
DeLoach.
Can you be more specific?
Did he have a one-on-one conversation with the captain, and that is how he determined that there was a smell of alcohol in his breath?
He detected some indication, yes.
In a face-to-face interview?
In a face-to-face.
And you're saying the tests weren't administered until 9:30 because they did not know there was a kid on board? And was that the Coast Guard's duty to administer those tests?
May I get some further information on this and get back to you?
Can you speak up, please?
I'll get some further information and be back to you on this.
Company, maritime, any kind of laws, rules, regulations regarding the use of that alco test on the ship should some sort of incident happen?
We're at the beginning of this, but it's
There are, these are the procedures which are coming to be used and have been established to take alcohol tests of people involved in marine casualties. There's been a lot of court decisions and so forth, but it is the thing that will be practiced.
Was there some rule regulation which should have required the use of that kit, A, by the ship's officers, B, by the Coast Guard, C, by someone else?
Let me find to go further than that until I get my facts better organized.
How much time passed from when the alcohol was noticed on the master's breath to the time when the test was administered?
I would like to decline until I get the factual answer I can give you on that.
Did the Coast Guard officer say 9:30 a.m., sir, that the test was administered?
I missed around 9:30, I believe.
And you said
that's my recollection.
If I could just follow up on that, you said the test was administered at 9:30 and the observation of liquor on breath was 3 a.m. 2 a.m.?
2:30, perhaps.
So we're talking perhaps about 7 hours?
Possibly.
And he had been on the ship since 9 o'clock, is that correct? 9 p.m. the previous evening?
The master.
Yes.
That's about right.
Has any alcohol or drugs been found on board?
Well, we're looking into that. We don't have any substantiation that works. We're certainly concerned about that. The Exxon regulations are very clear that there's not supposed to be any.
You haven't found any yet?
No.
Mr. Woody, did the Coast Guard officer who boarded the vessel, I think Mr. Delosier, did he characterize the demeanor of the captain?
CV, daily functional.
What?
Completely functional, in possession of his faculties, performing satisfactorily. No indication of anything wrong.
This was at the time that he also detected the odor of alcohol on the captain's breath?
At the same time.
Has the Coast Guard officer been interviewed as a witness?
We have interviewed him, yes.
Can you elaborate?
Nothing more than what I told you.
Is he the reason why no test was ordered immediately if he could smell alcohol?
Not precisely. We're looking for this.
Did the Coast Guard officer ask the captain if he had been drinking when he smelled alcohol in his breath?
Let me defer the question if I can until Friday, and I'll try to be back with you on about 10 save the on Friday.
Earlier that the helmsman, was it your impression or the helmsman's impression that he was heading back towards the shipping lane? When you were describing the series.
The helmsman didn't say that.
He didn't say that?
No.
Okay.
Could you tell us what the lapse time was from the time the helmsman got his first order of 10 degrees right until he heard the first order from the master?
We were unable to establish the time, but it was apparently a short period of time.
10 minutes?
Matter of a minute. We can't really tell.
I've had some folks tell me that there are some lights out there, some on the east, some on the west side as you're going through the traffic lanes, and that the man in charge could have gotten confused as to which direction he was going based on these various lights. He could have gotten thrown off course, thought he was heading one direction when in fact he was going.
The captain and the third officer, we might be able to determine what, if they did have some confusion factor, we don't have any reason to know what could have caused them to maneuver as they did. So I cannot speculate.
The impression from your account that we had this bump, the helmsman saying had a bumpy ride, and then there's a period of not a bumpy ride, and then a final grounding. Is that correct or not?
No, that's not correct. The bumpy ride probably was the grounding of the vessel.
I see. How about this? Is there any...
But that's speculation. So
is there anything from the helmsman's account that sounds like this first scraping on the starboard side that the company was talking about before the final grounding?
We have elicited nothing to indicate how the grounding occurred, except that it was a short, bumpy ride.
And you had...
That's only one witness.
You spoke of interviewing two helmsmen. Could you tell me when those helmsmen were on the bridge, when they switched?
The switch was near midnight, a few minutes before... The switch was a few minutes before midnight.
You mean you say you had... was the switch in the middle of this series of maneuvers to get out of the way of the ice that you've just described? In other words, did you have two helmsmen responding to orders from the third mate rather than just one?
There were probably three orders from the third mate based on what the helmsman said near the time of the grounding. There were probably three orders from the third mate at the time of the grounding. There was a right 10, a right 15, a right 20.
some followed by a hard right.
Did the Brumby ride commence on the watch of the second helmsman you interviewed, or did it commence on the watch of the first helmsman and then you switched helmsman before the grounding?
Well, the helmsman had been on the watch for a few moments, and it was, of course, actually the last helmsman we interviewed.
Mr. Woody, I don't think a lot of us have this clear. They had already veered beyond the inbound shipping lane and were near Bligh Reef when they got these series of three orders, right 10, right 15, right 20, is that correct? So those were the last orders just before the grounding, or as they were grounding?
The last orders, the hard right, that was during the bumpy ride.
Can't hear you.
The first helmsman that you interviewed, did you get the impression from his statements that when he left the watch, he did not think there was a problem? That everything seemed normal, just a normal adjustment of course? I'm trying to make sure that we don't have a situation where we're switching helmsmen in the middle of a crisis, which I would think would be odd.
No, there was no switch of helmsmen during the crisis. The helmsman on the helm had been... on there for some minutes, and he was steering a course of 180, said the vessel was steering well, and then he got some orders to change course to the right.
Okay, and then he's relieved?
No, he was not relieved.
This is the second helmsman.
The second helmsman. The helmsman on the watch at the time of the grounding was who received the orders. The grounding was about 4 minutes after midnight.
Why did the National Transportation Safety Board refuse to make copies of documents available to the state, such as ship's logs, forcing the state of Alaska to write a letter to the Coast Guard accusing it of obstruction of justice?
I can't answer your question exactly, but the documents that we hold are being made available to the state spokesperson. And when we establish our docket, all documents are open to the public.
The state spokesperson in the NTSB inquiry,
yes,
who was in there at Governor Cooper's personal request.
Yes.
But why did the criminal investigator not, why was the criminal investigator refused documents?
I can't answer your question.
When you said that the helmsman thought that perhaps the captain was on the bridge and just didn't see him, is the bridge, toilets in the bridge where the captain could be on the bridge and the helmsman not to know he's there?
That would be possible. It's a large area.
Mr. Woody, how would you characterize the Coast Guard's role in this? Did they perform within the full range of their duties and responsibilities, or were they a little negligent, and maybe that's too harsh?
We have no reason to believe that there's any problem.
What would have been the normal scenario at that time of night? What would have been the absolute optimal scenario on board that ship at that time of night? Can you give us a little, just a thumbnail sketch?
Well, by regulations, the ship is required to have an officer who has a pilot's endorsement on the bridge. And we haven't established it. By not interviewing the people, we have not established the whereabouts of the captain who had the endorsement.
Mr. Woody, was the Coast Guard's delay in doing the alcohol test inappropriate in any way?
I cannot characterize that. We all do the very best we can.
Did the Coast Guard officer say or do anything at all when he noticed that the captain had alcohol in his breath? Did he take any action or did he say anything at all?
I have no knowledge to answer your question.
Sir, can you repeat the officer's name and spell it for us, please?
One officer, Mark DeLozier, was a boarding officer, went to the ship. Mark DeLozier.
Mr. Woody, you've given us a bunch of courses here. Are these magnetic? You've given us a bunch of courses, 180, 235. Are these magnetic or true courses?
These are all true courses.
These are all true courses.
Okay. I've been an 18-year resident and fisherman here in Valdez, and I own and operate a million-dollar fishing operation. I have been oftentimes in contact with the Valdez traffic system that monitors this outer portion of the arm. Now, I'm down around Glacier Island, which most of these people won't understand, but it's several miles past the point of impact. I have been called up and asked by Valdez traffic and not outcoming tankers, if I would deviate my course from whatever heading mostly is northerly for me to come home, it's around 10 degrees north, and as a courtesy would call up and ask that I possibly give these ships a little more room to port or starboard. Mm-hmm. My point being that they can see me, a 72-foot fiberglass fishing boat, several miles past the point of impact, clearly see me and tell me which way to go and know which way I'm going. It's my question as to, with all the sophisticated electronics that these people have got implemented, why would the Coast Guard not be able to pull this guy off when they knew or could most likely see that he was on an impact course?
The radar at about Busby Point was not showing the tanker clearly.
I see. And could you also tell us what kind of electronics? These must be some fairly decent radar on the ships themselves. Is there not also radar operating on each vessel?
On each vessel, yes, there are. There are two.
Are there also people that monitor those electronics specifically, like a navigator, or is that the duty of the helmsman also?
The duty of monitoring the navigation is the watch officer, and the helmsman's duty is to steer the vessel.
So there should be then two people present in the wheelhouse.
That's correct, and there were two people.
What was the exact time of the final Coast Guard contact with this ship, and what was the final communication?
I don't know the exact time. The final communication was that the vessel wanted to maneuver within to avoid ice, and that they were coming to a course of 200.
I didn't hear the last part.
That they were coming to a course of 200.
But they actually went to a course of 180.
Eventually.
Mr. Woody.
Okay. I have further interviews I must be going off for, and I'd like to thank you very much.
Are you going to be holding another news conference?
We have a public affairs person coming in to the area, and that'll be decided sometime tomorrow, I would say. They will decide, and there will be a decision made tomorrow regarding when the next press conference
is. D-E-L-O-U-Z-I-E-R, is that correct, Mr. Woody?
Well, William Woody, the NTSB spokesman who has just been speaking, has just been surrounded by about 25 members of the press corps, like he was bait to a school of hungry salmon. Finally, the first real hard information that has been released about the events leading up to the grounding of the Exxon Valdez. There are still some questions remaining, significant questions, but just to quickly recap, the course heading of the vessel when the incident began was 180 degrees. That was a true course. That's due south. For those who maybe have been following this or are familiar with the tanker lanes, I don't know the exact compass heading, but the tanker traffic lane where the vessel should have been would have been a heading that would be west-southwest, or south-southwest, not heading due south. So the vessel was clearly outside of the tanker lane. The Coast Guard permission to deviate that had been issued was to deviate only from the western side of the traffic lane, the outbound lane, across the separation strip to the inbound or east side of the traffic lane. The vessel clearly was well to the east of the approved traffic lanes. There were a series of orders given to the helmsman by the third mate following what the helmsman characterized a bumpy ride. The captain reappeared or reasserted himself on the bridge and began to issue orders, some of which were contradictory. The NTSB spokesman did say that they have not been able to interview the captain or third mate about the specifics of the grounding because the attorneys for those gentlemen have advised them not to speak about that. The hearing Tuesday in Anchorage that had been scheduled has been delayed possibly some weeks, according to William Woody. Some other information that came out there was an indication that the captain or the master of the vessel had alcohol on his breath. This is a report from Coast Guard Warrant Officer Mark Delosier, who was the first Coast Guard officer to board the stricken vessel. That was about 2 o'clock, 2:15 a.m., Good Friday morning, within an hour, within a couple of hours of the actual grounding. At that time, Warrant Officer Delosier reported the captain seemed functional and alert. The pilot who left the vessel prior to the grounding also indicated that the captain seemed alert and capable. Nonetheless, Warrant Officer Mark Delosier of the Coast Guard, the first Coast Guard officer on the scene, indicated there was alcohol on the breath of the captain. An interesting wrinkle in the story is that there was an alcohol blood test kit on board the vessel, but the Coast Guard officials and DEC officials were not made aware of the existence of this kit. The alcohol blood test on the captain and crew members did not occur until 9:30, some 7 hours after the first indication to the Coast Guard warrant officer that there had been alcohol on the breath of the captain. That took that time to get an alcohol blood test kit out to the vessel, evidently. Some other information that has come out was that the third mate, who was on the bridge and in control of the Exxon Valdez, evidently contrary to both Exxon regulations and U.S. maritime law, was on watch after his usual shift would have been over. The third mate was evidently standing additional watch hours while the vessels are in Port Valdez at the Alyeska Marine Terminal loading. Regular cruise shifts continue. The vessels are in the port only long enough to take on oil. In the case of a tanker the size of the Exxon Valdez, the total stay in port might only be 20 to 30 hours, about 1 day. Crew schedules continue to operate. Evidently, the third mate had been on duty and was kept on duty longer than his regular shift. No reason was given for that extended shift. And that's basically the information we heard today. One other note is that the state and Exxon are parties in the investigation. Again, the NTSB does not assign criminal penalties or is not a criminal court of review. Their job is to review the events leading to the incident, to find out exactly what caused the incident to occur, and to make recommendations to prevent such reoccurrences. Parties to the investigation at this point are Exxon, who has not indicated or nominated their spokesman to be with the NTSB panel at the hearings. The state of Alaska is also a party. The state has appointed Captain Kelly Mitchell, who is the port captain of the Alaska State Ferry Fleet and a master mariner, to be the state of Alaska spokesman on the NTSB investigation board. And that does basically cover all of the events that occurred that this morning's briefing by the NTSB. There was an indication that an NTSB public affairs person is en route, so we may be able to get more regular briefings of the conduct of the investigation. One question that was raised, and seems to be a good one, is why the hearings, which have now again been delayed for some weeks, the hearings will not start next Tuesday in Anchorage, the public hearings by the NTSB. But the question was raised, why are these hearings not being held in Valdez, where there are people who are familiar with the area, with the waters, and with the conditions under which tankers and other vessels ply the waters of Valdez Arm and Prince William Sound? We were told that that decision is made by headquarters, by the higher-ups at the NTSB, and that the team on the site had no control over where the hearings would be scheduled. At this point is about all from the Civic Center Ballroom. We do have scheduled a press briefing by Exxon at 11 o'clock. That's the morning briefing. We expect Don Cornett back from Cordova to be the spokesman. We have heard no changes in that plan. We anticipate it coming up. We will broadcast the We will broadcast that meeting, and we will be feeding it down the line to those stations who are listening through the Alaskan Bridge. I want to thank KCHU staffer Mary Beth Joyce for her assistance in this broadcast. Engineering back at the KCHU studios has been James Winchester. A quick reminder that at 12 noon following the Exxon briefing, there is a press conference scheduled by a coalition of environmental groups. We've announced in the past that the Prince William Sound Conservation Alliance and Trustees for Alaska are here, as well as the Sierra Club and Greenpeace, also added to that list now is the organization Earth First. And that environmentalist press conference will be at 12 noon, and again, will be carried by KCHU. Finally, we're anticipating the arrival sometime today of the return of the U.S. Department of Transportation Secretary, the Coast Guard Commandant, and the head of the EPA. They were in town briefly yesterday, then did an overflight of the oil spill area. Again, now the almost entire southwestern Prince William Sound area. They flew back to Anchorage to Elmendorf Air Force Base. We're anticipating their return today. If there is a press conference or a briefing by these gentlemen, we will certainly carry that on KCHU. For now, I'm Dave Hammack from the Civic Center. This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.